Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Board of Trustees of Ohio State University has approved an increase in tuition and fees for incoming first-year students, bringing the total cost of attendance to nearly $27,000 a year for incoming freshmen. But the hike is coupled with a freeze and more money for grants and scholarships. Running an institution the likes of OSU is an expensive proposition, but attracting a shrinking number of students nationally to pay the freight is getting more complicated as well. Coming up, we'll hear about what's happening across the country to make ends meet. Joining us now is the Executive Vice President and Provost of The Ohio State University, Bruce McFerrin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Happy to be here.
How is tuition calculated? What goes into that equation?
Well, you know, it's a simple word, but a complex formula that underlies it. And for a lot of students and their families, what you said just a moment ago is exactly the right thing. That is the total cost of attendance, because the tuition is what we actually ask students and their families to cover toward their actual instructional experiences. There are some other fees that fit into that, several of which we continue to hold constant, even under the guarantee program. They won't be increasing this year for anyone. Things like using the recreational facility, RPAC, things like the bus pass that we provide to COTA, and those sorts of things.
When did has tuition and fees always have they always been two separate categories in your experience in the last 20-odd years?
Well, you know, in higher education, tuition covers that instructional cost, and then fees are the add-on components to this. When we say tuition, we mean tuition plus a very succinct category of set of fees. The couple that I mentioned, for example, there's a fee that the students voted in some years ago when the Ohio Union was remodeled and reconstructed to help pay off that facility. Then on top of that, there are a variety across higher education, a variety of other fees. There may be fees for particular courses that are much more expensive to operate, something where like a chemistry lab or an art course, you're using up supplies that are provided. There are textbooks that are outside of this this total cost.
Right.
And then there's the room and board, whether you're living on campus or off campus. Those are real costs for our students.
This is a national story as far as the tuition freezes and holding down tuition. That's the thing that most people think of when they think of the cost of college, but also increasing fees on the side. So paying for all the extras with an increasing number of fees and by increasing those fees as well. How does that play out at Ohio State?
Well, one of the things that we have taken on as an opportunity with entering into the tuition guarantee that Ohio law provides for us is this is a chance for us to actually systematically go through all of those fees and really make an effort to simplify for students and their families what their bills actually are. It's a very complex suite of things that has evolved over time, and so we're going to have to take a little time to do it right, but that's our job as we go into this next academic year at the central level to actually try to understand where all those fees are, how much they are, and how we can actually mitigate some of those costs.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the cost of college today. My guest right now, Executive Vice President and Provost at Ohio State University, Bruce McFerrin. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The state share of the cost of higher education has changed dramatically, at least in my experience, over the last 30 years. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes, it has. You know, my window here at Ohio State is the past 5 years. I was at Penn State before, and we observed a very similar sort
right.
of thing. I think it's really a national trend. Some of the states have actually been able to retain a higher level of contribution. Over the past three or so biennial budgets here in Ohio, we've seen an erosion of somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10 to somewhere between 10 and 15% of what the state is able to provide the four-year schools, and that has ended up coming to Ohio State. You'll recall a couple budgets ago, We actually shifted the formula here in Ohio of how funding from the state is awarded. And so we're in a world of 50% of the state funding actually is allocated not for simply having students in class, but rather for granting degrees. So it's a success-based formula.
Do you know how, and therein lies that whole line of questions, do you know how the cost of schooling affects the dropout rate at Ohio State?
The simple answer is no. The more complicated and nuanced answer is that's something we're trying to understand every day. We actually are working with a number of groups across the country, like-minded universities, to try to develop some data analytics tools, big data, to be able to really tease apart some of these very complicated variables. We still serve a large number of families that are sending children off to college for the first time here in Ohio.
I mean first generation?
First generation college students. That's a significant – actually at some of our regional campuses, that proportion approaches 50% of our student body.
They're coming here, but are they staying?
And so what we see if they come to the Columbus campus as freshmen, we have excellent success at retention. You know, those retention rates from first year to second are in the 90s. So there's room for improvement, but not a lot of room for improvement at Ohio State. We'll continue to push on that. The graduation rate, which we normally measure because the federal government measured this way at six-year graduation rate for a baccalaureate degree, is in the mid-80s. So we're doing a great job under those metrics if students start at the Columbus campus in getting them through to graduation.
At the regional campuses,
it's a challenge. There you have students who may not carry a full load. They're much more likely to be first-generation college students, so they don't necessarily have the support network in their lives to be able to understand what it takes to transition from high school to college. Those are open-access campuses. Over 20 years, the Columbus campus has become much more selective in admissions around student attainment. So we've seen the average ACT score increase. We've seen the proportion of students in the top 10% and 25% of their classes increase over time. But the regional campuses provide true access. If you have a high school degree from Ohio, you may be admitted as a Buckeye.
So how do you suss out graduation, you know, completion rates when it comes to regional and the home main campus? Is it a function of who's going into the regional campuses, or is there something about the main campus that helps students succeed more?
I think it's primarily what students are starting and the skill sets that they bring from high school. This, again, is something that actually as we implement some of these data analytics tools, we hope to be able to really understand, because what we would love is to completely eliminate that gap between success that, you know, if you come to college, we want you to leave with a credential. We want you to leave with that degree, because the data are clear that college attainment still counts for something in the marketplace of your career.
Where in the calculations for tuition do you have the figure for a tipping point? How do you know what the tipping point is and what will affect enrollment?
We actually benchmark extensively with our peer institutions. So we use several different benchmarks, but for tuition and room and board, the most salient are looking at the other public universities in Ohio. So we look at some of the other selective universities. We look at the Ohio U's, the Miami's, the Cincinnati's to benchmark costs. But we know also that, and so we lose some students based on cost back and forth between those institutions. But we, on a broader scale, are actually in competition with the Big Ten universities. That's a great peer comparison for us. we know from the data on students that we have accepted but who choose not to enroll here that many of them are going to those peer institutions. And so again, it's you know, trying to there's an art and a science to this, and sometimes the art outweighs the science of trying to take a look at the comparables. We are extremely affordable, and even under the 6% tuition increase of the tuition guarantee, that pencils out to 5.5% on tuition, and then the room and board, a room is 6 and board is 3. So the aggregate for an Ohio resident coming in as a freshman this year would be a 5.8% increase. Even at that increased rate, we're still the fourth or fifth most affordable university in the Big Ten, and we fall below a number of our Ohio peers at in terms of affordability.
But that's all a relative calculation. Mm-hmm. It's not, I mean, meanwhile, back at the ranch in the state of Ohio, although unemployment rates have decreased, wage compensation levels have not kept pace by far with it doesn't even count with the inflation, but we're not anywhere close to what we were 10 and 15 years ago.
Absolutely. And so every time we make a decision, and I'll just remind you and our listeners that this is the first time in 5 years that we've actually proposed to increase tuition. And by the way, our returning students, those coming back as sophomores, juniors, seniors, will not face a tuition increase. They still will have the same level they did. But we always couple this with conversations about need-based aid. And so there is a place where we're really moving the needle under President Drake's leadership.
President Trump has proposed in his budget cutting and just a raft of funding programs for college tuition, for college loans. Are any particular concerns there?
Well, we're watching it very carefully. Pell, work right. study, the loan programs and the tuition caps and expectations all are proposed. What I remind my colleagues constantly about the budget process, either at the state or federal level, is in fact the noun in the sentence is process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a proposal, whether it's from the governor at the state level or the president at the federal level, and then there is a lot of conversation, and you know that's the nature of our government. If you look at the state budget this year and compare what Governor Kasich proposed back in the winter to what we signed into law here at the 11th hour, literally, on June 30th, very different in some of the higher education elements. And so, you know, we're watching and continuing to have conversations with our elected officials about the potential impacts of some of these changes.
This is a question that's been pending for a long time, but there's been a recent flurry of publicity about that, and that's about the ultimate value of college. There was a poll that was released in recent days saying that most Americans, particularly Republicans, don't think that college holds the same value that it once did. It's not worth it.
Well, you know, so here's the provost of one of the nation's leading public universities saying it's not all about the four-year degree. I think we need a lot of options for students, and the same endpoint is not right for every citizen of the U.S. There's extraordinary value in the educational process itself. Here at Ohio State, we do everything we can to expose students to an incredible array of different ways of thinking about problems, ways of talking to people from different parts of the world, across the country, different economic status. We like to think of ourselves as an opportunity for our students to actually grow up as citizens of the world through the process. The data clearly indicate that although the gap has narrowed, there still is a lifetime economic value to holding these degrees. But we need to, I think, constantly be testing what credentials citizens want. You know, for some people, just having access to a single course at the right time in their career may enable them to take the next step in career development.
Is that Ohio State's role, though? It's such a gigantic institution. Can it turn on a dime like that and offer those kinds of details to people?
Well, I don't know. It may be turning on a quarter.
Okay.
You know, this is a big organization,
right.
It can take a lot of time to change. But, you know, for example, we've been working with our distance education team and really surveying how other places have done this. We're not proposing to get into the business of competing with the University of Phoenix, for example. But there are a lot of places where we know the market will bear interest in a Buckeye degree, an Ohio State degree in some particular subject. Just in the past year, I'm happy to say that we've authorized at the faculty level across campus using certificates, which are a credential that's really important to a lot of people, but not the full commitment to a degree. And so we continue to really adjust that. We've got some conversations going on now with regards to our strategic plan about the notion of whether there might be a way that we could offer to every Ohio State student an opportunity to get some micro-credential in coding, for example. So whatever your major, you know how to turn it into an app. Just as a value-added sort of thing that doesn't change the course workload, doesn't change time to degree, but continues to add value. I think we have to evolve and continue to reevaluate exactly what our mission is.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
That's Bruce McFerrin. He's Executive Vice President and Provost of Ohio State University. We'll continue our conversation about the cost of college. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the cost of college. Ohio State University recently approved a tuition increase and a freeze for incoming first-year students. But housing and dining fees will increase. And research has shown that such cost hikes cost universities in enrollment. For many, when the first bill arrives, they drop out. The value of a college degree is borne out in research that correlates the achievement with higher lifetime earnings. But the cost is killing that prospect for many students, or putting them in so much debt that they forego other rites of passage, such as home ownership or marriage. Joining us now by phone is higher education editor for the Hechinger Report, a nonprofit independent news organization focused on inequality and innovation in education. John Marcus, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also with us is the Executive Vice President of Policy Research at the Institute for Higher Education Policy, Mamie Voigt. Welcome to the show, Mamie.
Thank you.
Looking back, Mamie Voigt, can you tell us what the main factors were that have contributed to the rise of college costs, let's say, over the last 30 or 40 years when the big increases occurred?
Sure. And we really have seen big increases over the past several decades, with college costs rising 4.5 times the rate of inflation, 4 times faster than family income, and even twice as fast as healthcare costs. And a number of factors are at play here, but one of the biggest factors influencing college costs at public universities is the state investment in higher education. And we have seen the states disinvesting on a per-student basis over the past several decades, so that now students and families have to shoulder nearly half of the burden of the cost of attending a public college. And that's up from about a quarter of the cost in just the early 90s. So the states play a really important role here in helping to keep costs low for students, especially when we're talking about tuition and fees.
Some people are saying, John Marcus, that a lot of public universities really aren't public anymore. They're more quasi-private public.
That's true. That's because the proportion of their budgets that are covered by their states has fallen to single digits in some cases. And those costs, as Mamie points out, have to be passed on to someone, and they're passed on to students. That's, to a large degree, why higher education is an easy target. in state houses and governor's offices. It's because they know there's an alternative source of revenue. That is that colleges can raise tuition, and the colleges get blamed for it. The politicians don't, and that's what we've been seeing happening over the last few decades.
But is there, Mamie Voigt, a backdrop of changing philosophy about the role of government in higher education? Do lawmakers not feel an obligation toward higher education that they once did?
I think that, you know, a lot of this increase in college costs and decreased state investment happened during the recession, when states were faced with really difficult decisions about how to balance their budgets. And as John mentioned, higher education is a target because students and families are there to pick up part of the cost. The problem there is that students, especially low-income students and middle-income students, end up really being burdened by those increased costs, and it makes it harder for them to go to college at all. When the costs go up, especially if financial aid is failing to keep pace with those increased costs. So I think it's really about states trying to balance the various priorities there. But what's so important for states to recognize is that investment in higher education is really investment in the economic development of the state itself. And by investing today in colleges and universities, it can pay off in increased tax revenue down the line, which will help to strengthen the state in the long run.
Pardon me. John Marcus, are there any states that are doing it right, in the opinion of researchers out there, that are finding that sweet spot, that balance that makes sense for typical American family and, you know, taxpayers?
Well, yes and no. And I'm glad you asked that, because picking up on what Mamie just said, a couple of states sort of bucked this trend during the recession. And they were two states that you might not have expected to see a reinvestment in higher education. One was North Dakota and one was Alaska. And one of the reasons that they were able to do this was at the time they had a lot of oil revenue, and that has declined. And so as role models, they are less of examples to us now, because that oil money has petered out a little bit. But these are red states that understood that they needed to have locally trained, for example, in North Dakota, engineers. Because while there were a lot of great $60,000-a-year jobs driving trucks to the oil fields, what they found was that the engineers, the really high-paying jobs, were being imported from other states because there weren't enough of them in North Dakota. So North Dakota went on this huge spree of supporting in a very sensible way programs at the higher education level to produce its own engineers and to give opportunities to its own young people to get those sort of degrees and get those jobs. So those were two really good examples that bucked the trend since the recession. And although their money has run out because the oil boom has subsided, they made a good case.
So they bucked the trend because they could buck the trend. They had resources that other states didn't during this recession.
Yes, and they came to the logical conclusion that, as Mamie says, this is a good investment over time. You know, if you look at the growth areas all over the country, in places like Silicon Valley and the Route 128 area around Boston, the Research Triangle, these are all places with very high levels of education, of post-secondary education, that's driving economies. And when you see areas with lower degree proportions, you see much lower economic activity.
Mamie Voigt, you published research this spring that showed that about 70% of colleges are unaffordable for working and middle-class students. What do we mean by unaffordable now?
Sure. In that research, we were looking at what is affordable for students of various income backgrounds, and we used this rule of 10 as this affordability benchmark to evaluate affordability. The rule of 10 says that a student can afford to go to college if they save for 10 years, their family saves 10% of their family income for 10 years before college, and then the student works for 10 hours a week while in college. And the earnings from that work plus the savings from their family in advance of college, what that adds up to is what they would have available to pay for college costs. Now, for some students, they are not able to save anything before college because their income is so low. So we're looking at 10% of a family's discretionary income that they have available to save as a benchmark. And what we found in looking at that pretty realistic benchmark of what a family sitting around a kitchen table would be able to pull together for college costs is that high-income students can afford about 90% of colleges and universities. But low-income students and middle-income students can afford only between 1 and 5% of colleges because that net price or the cost after they've received all of their grants and scholarships still really outpaces the benchmark affordability measure that we looked at based on that rule of 10 of what a student actually could afford.
So their prospects are narrowed at the outset because of affordability.
Absolutely. Students need to be able to come up with that additional amount of money to cover college costs, and that's after they've exhausted a lot of their family resources. So in many cases, they have to turn to borrowing and taking out loans to cover those costs, or they need to work far more hours while in school than will allow them to be successful in focusing on their studies in order to make up the difference. Both that borrowing and that extra work hurts their chances of ultimately graduating and succeeding in college. And so this really plays into the need for states, for colleges and universities, and for the federal government to be targeting grant aid, financial aid, towards the lowest income students who need the most support in order to make up that difference and be able to afford college, access it, and succeed once they're there.
John Marcus, from what you've looked at, how quickly do colleges know how affordable they are in any given year when there's been a tuition increase or a tuition cut or a freeze? I mean, is it reflected immediately in enrollment?
I'm not sure I can entirely answer that question, but I can answer it in this way, that unfortunately, although, as Mamie says, we need some attention to this issue, we're actually going in the wrong direction. That if you look at programs that we all think help low-income students pay for college, they are disproportionately benefiting higher-income students, higher-income families whose children would likely go to college even without them. So,
like scholarships and that kind of a thing.
Scholarships, financial federal tax credits, 529 savings plans benefit higher-income families.
Gotcha.
We subsidize those as taxpayers with what's now a $2 billion a year tax deductions for those plans, which are mostly held by higher income families. That'll rise in a few years to $4 billion a year. Federal tuition tax credits, we spend more on tax breaks for tuition than we do on Pell Grants, which are direct grants for low-income students. And those grants go to families that earn as much as $180,000 a year. Institutional financial aid, including at public universities, often goes to students who don't need the money, but it's an inducement to encourage students to enroll at a time when enrollment, in particular, incidentally, in states such as Ohio, the supply of 18 to 24-year-olds is down. So in order to incentivize those students to come to your institution, you give them discounts. And those discounts are disproportionately going to higher-income students. The typical private nonprofit university gives $5,800 per year per student above what the federal formula says they need to pay for college to students from families that make $155,000 a year or more. So we're not helping those lower-income students, and the trend is in the other direction.
You wrote about Ohio Wesleyan University here in Central Ohio, in Delaware, Ohio, in June, in the Hechinger Report, and it was interesting to see how they're trying to respond to these things in with a much greater sense of immediacy.
They're being impressively proactive with this because it's too late for a sense of immediacy. There's been an enrollment decline. We're now in the sixth year of an enrollment decline. There's 2.4 million fewer students than there were 5 years ago. That's unheard. I talked to a consultant that said that's never happened in the history of higher education. So you have all of these pressures, and you know, let's realize that all of these issues, such as what the provost talked about earlier, also are having an extraordinarily significant sort of putting stress on these institutions themselves. So a variation in a few students and a couple of dozen students in your freshman class can make or break your operating budget. Ohio Wesleyan is getting well ahead of this in ways that they were willing to share with us by adding sports teams, because a lot of their enrollment decline is among men. Men are disproportionately unlikely to go to college. Women far outnumber men in college now. They're adding majors that they think will attract people by analyzing data that shows postgraduate job prospects. Where are the jobs, and what can we teach students that will get them jobs? That's obviously what students want, but that colleges have taken a long time to respond to. So, yeah, they're doing some really innovative things there.
Do you suspect that smaller schools like Ohio Wesleyan are going to be in a better position to respond because things are changing so fast in the marketplace?
I don't think they have a choice. I was on Friday and Saturday at Antioch College and in Yellow Springs, mm-hmm. and they, as you may recall, closed for 3 years, and the alumni have reopened the college. They were sort of a canary in the coal mine for small liberal arts colleges. Mm-hmm. Even their continued existence is precarious, but they've been doing some really impressive things with the help of alumni who feel really engaged with that institution. Do students today feel that engaged with their institutions? There's polling by Gallup and others that show they don't.
Yeah.
Students are more likely to transfer, so they don't have that kind of loyalty to the university that previous generations might have had. Universities, to increase enrollment, are adding programs left and right that sort of muddy the market. They don't differentiate themselves one from another anymore. They all seem to be the same. And so unless you have a really good value proposition for the price you're charging, those sort of smaller tuition-dependent private nonprofit universities and colleges are in big trouble, including in places like Ohio that happens to have a lot of them.
Right. We'll continue our conversation about the cost of college. You just heard from John Marcus. He's a higher education editor for the Hechinger Report. It's a nonprofit independent news organization focused on inequality and innovation in education. Also with us, Mamie Voigt. She's executive vice president of policy research at the Institute for Higher Education Policy. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The cost to attend college has risen at a rate above that of inflation in recent decades. To pay the freight, students and their families are borrowing about $100 billion every year. Can this equation endure? Still with us is higher education editor for the Hechinger Report, a nonprofit independent news organization focused on inequality and innovation in education, John Marcus. Also with us is executive vice president of policy research at the Institute of Higher Education Policy, Mamie Voigt. Mamie, let's talk about the distinction between tuition and what that pays for, and room and board and all the fees associated with college. Isn't it the combination of everything and not just tuition that's at the root of the problem?
It really is. Students need to be able to pay their tuition and fees. Certainly they need to pay those bills to the university. But in order to attend college, they also need to pay their room and board, pay other living expenses, pay for things like books and supply and transportation to campus. So when thinking about the college affordability issues facing students today, we really need that holistic view of all of the expenses facing students, that total cost of attendance. And so it's important in thinking about financial aid policies to make sure that grant aid that is available to students is able to be used for this whole host of expenses that are facing those students.
It's almost as if you're middle income or lower income, if you look at what things are really going to cost out there, you wouldn't even try to start going because it's so monumental, the debt, because it really boils down to how much debt you can afford to take on, right?
that's a huge part of the equation. And that's why getting information to students about the actual prices that they'll have to pay is really important, because most students don't pay the total cost of attendance because they're getting some form of financial aid. They're, in many cases, low-income students are getting Pell Grants to help them cover some of the cost of college. In some cases, they're getting state grants to help cover the cost, and then in many cases, they're also getting grant or scholarship aid from the college itself. And the challenge is, as John mentioned, in many cases, we're going in the wrong direction on these various different financial aid pieces of the puzzle, with declining purchasing power of the Pell Grant, which is our federal program aimed to help low-income students afford college. And we're seeing at the institution level many public and private nonprofit colleges shifting their aid from need to non-need-based aid. So public colleges used to spend more than twice as much on aid for needy students, but now they spend more in financial aid on wealthy students than on low-income students. And we see a similar trend at private nonprofit colleges, where they're now spending twice as much on students in the highest income quintile than those in the lowest income quintiles. So the amount that is actually being dedicated to students is important, in addition to that communication to students about what they actually will be expected to pay once they enroll.
Now, OSU Provost Bruce McFerrin said this is all part of a larger process, but I wanted to raise the specter of President Trump's the budget that he released in May, a proposed budget. He called it a new foundation for American greatness, and it comes with really massive cuts, eliminates six loan and grant programs, providing financial aid to low-income and working-class students. And Betsy DeVos, U.S. Secretary of Education, defended it this way. She said, the budget also reflects a series of tough choices we've had to make when assessing the best use of taxpayer money, adding that if approved, the new fiscal year 18 budget would save taxpayers $142 billion over the next 10 years. Mamie Voigt, I mean, is there another equation out there that counters that about what it would cost Americans if they pulled this rug out?
It would be a huge cost to Americans, and especially the low and middle income students who are really aspiring to get a college degree and improve their life circumstances. Now, while it certainly is a process to prepare the federal budget, what we're seeing is that every step in this process so far, the Pell Grant program is under attack and is facing cuts. And this is the most well-targeted program at the federal level in higher education. So, for example, in the FY17 budget, we saw a $1.3 billion cut to the Pell Grant program. And just yesterday, House appropriators cut another $3.3 billion from the program and froze the maximum grant award. That's a huge deal for students because the award has failed to keep pace with the rising cost of college. Today, it only covers about a third of the cost of attending a public four-year institution. And if we don't increase the award every year, at least with inflation, mm-hmm. it's going to continue to lose that purchasing power. And that hurts students directly as they're trying to pay their college costs. So it is a process, but every step in that process has been moving in the wrong direction as far as we've seen.
Mm-hmm. John Marcus, I mean, this is something that universities, colleges, particularly smaller outfits, like you mentioned, have to worry about, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're worried about the continued supply of students in general, and so they have to be worried about people making that decision based on the equation of the benefit to them, the return on their investment. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York says that a typical college bachelor's degree recipient will make 15% more over his or her lifetime than people without a degree. But if you're just beginning to consider going to college and borrowing, the fastest growing demographic in this country are first generation racial and ethnic minorities. First generation meaning that their own parents didn't go to college. They are particularly debt averse. They don't like to move away from where they live to go to college and live on some campus at some distance. So they're more likely to go to local community colleges or second-tier regional public universities that have very low levels of resources and, as a result, very low graduation rates. So we're just sort of sticking people in this cycle wherein they do borrow. If they do choose, if they do make the sort of bold decision to go to college, we saddle them with debt. They often don't get a degree, and then you can't get rid of student debt. It's one of the unique elements of student loans, even in bankruptcy. So you're stuck with this debt. You don't have a degree, and you're sort of stuck in this downward cycle. And instead of sort of being a ladder up the economic scale, higher education is sort of cementing people into place.
So just to reiterate, we have a shrinking number of high school graduates, unprecedented, with an increasing proportion of first-time college-bound and immigrant and students with immigrant backgrounds, who are all of whom are debt averse and more interested in staying close to home. It sounds like, Mamie Voigt, there's sort of a sea change going on here. We're maybe a little too close to it right now, but you guys have to be looking at that. Something's going to have to give, right?
Absolutely. The students entering college today look different than they did in the past. We have more adult students pursuing higher education, more low-income students, more first-generation college goers, and that's incredibly important as we think about our financial aid system and as colleges think about how to serve the students of today and ensure that they have the greatest opportunities to succeed as possible. All of this is incredibly important to help close the equity gaps that we see in our system, in our educational system. While college going has gone up among all students over the past several decades, low-income students today actually go to college at the same rates as high-income students did 40 years ago. So there's a lot of room left to improve here in terms of getting low-income students to college and through college. While half of all people from high-income families will earn a bachelor's degree by young adulthood, only 1 in 10 people from low-income families will. So to really make progress in trying to close those gaps and getting more low-income students, more first-generation students, and more students of color access to a college degree so that they can achieve that upward social mobility and contribute as best as possible to the state and the nation's economy, we simply need to make sure that our colleges and universities are accessible and affordable and set up to help those students succeed once they enroll.
John Marcus, you've done some reporting on polls that show public opinion on colleges is changing. For example, a recent survey showed that 58% of people thought that universities put their own interests ahead of those of students. You know, I mean, I spent 10 years paying off student loans, and I struggled financially through college, but I loved every single second of it, had a super experience. I'm in the minority now as far as thinking that it's worth it.
I think colleges and universities are victims of some of their own histories. But I will say that three-quarters of Americans do still think that it's easier to succeed in life with a college degree. This
okay.
is according to a survey by the Foundation New America. But only 43% think it's worth the cost. Forgive me, that private, nonprofit universities and colleges are worth the cost. And I think what happened over time, and I say this as somebody that was covering higher education over a period of time, is that people sort of put universities and colleges on a moral high ground, and they assumed that these were institutions that would treat them fairly. I mean, how could a university or college, you know, treat you poorly? These were special kind of rarefied, you know, intellectual kinds of places that were separate from the rest of our society. They were not for profit. Over the years, people began to see abuses by leadership of universities and colleges. And even though it may have been isolated to one institution or another, that reflects on all colleges and universities, they began to see things such as something that we've documented, that is that the number of administrators at colleges and universities has increased twice as fast as the number of students in the last 25 years. And while there's no empirical research that suggests how much that contributes to the cost of college, it's only logical that that is having an impact. You're seeing a decline in the number of full-time tenure-track faculty. So students who are paying much, much more to go to college are actually getting much, much less from it. You're seeing financial aid offers that are misleading and difficult to compare from one institution to another. You're seeing statistics that are provided by colleges to prospective students that show postgraduate job prospects and postgraduate incomes that are that the colleges aren't telling you are sort of randomly derived from unscientific surveys of alumni. So all of these things are happening. You mentioned earlier not only fees but room and board.
Yeah.
Room and board is increasing much faster than tuition and much faster than inflation. And we took a look at dining costs at colleges and universities are exceeding the cost of food. And now a typical meal at a typical college exceeds what the Food and Drug Administration says should Americans pay for a meal. So that because the universities can generate revenue from that while making their tuition look as if it isn't going up so quickly. So over time, I think that's contributed to some skepticism and cynicism among Americans about these colleges.
Because they're not giving them the straight shot, because, as we mentioned earlier, funding at the state level has decreased dramatically. It's easy to just shove it off on colleges. Do you think colleges are doing a good job of explaining these kinds of issues that they're facing?
No.
Why?
I think colleges are not very good at public relations. I think that with many important exceptions. But I think that university presidents often speak like a doctoral thesis and people feel spoken down to. I think colleges and universities have for too long said, trust us, and these poll results suggest that people no longer do. So I think that's changing, and there are some standouts like Rock Jones at Ohio Wesleyan and one of my favorite university president names, by the way. The other one is King Alexander, which is another great name, who's the chancellor at Louisiana State. Very, very good at sort of speaking very candidly. Here's the problem university presidents have. They have enormous numbers of constituencies, students, parents, faculty, alumni, and they have to keep and donors, critically, they have to keep everybody happy. So where 10 or 15 years ago you would have heard university presidents not only chime in about the direction that we're taking financial aid that should be going to poor students and giving it to wealthy students, you would hear them speaking about national issues and topics of political interest. Now university presidents, in my experience, are sort of keeping their heads low and trying not to get noticed. So the short answer to your question is no, I don't think colleges are particularly good at telling their own story.
Mamie Voigt, can this endure, given the demographics going forward, given the shrinking numbers of students that just can't possibly, I don't know, see how the United States bounces back from the shrinking numbers of college-eligible, college-age students? Something's going to have to give, right?
It will, and it will need to in order to meet the economic needs of our country in the future. Labor economists project that by 2020, 65% of all U.S. jobs will require a college education, and we're projected to fall short of that number. And so in order to meet those economic needs of the future, we simply need to be making changes in order to serve the students of today.
So that making sure that more students can go to college since there are fewer of them out there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
More low-income students,
yeah,
students of color in particular.
Okay.
And I think, you know, underlying John's point is the important idea that different institutions address this differently, and what colleges and universities do really matters. So that some colleges that are stepping up and saying that their priority is going to be to serve students and in particular to serve first-generation college goers, they set that as a priority at the top of the institution at the leadership levels, and they are willing to speak out about that being their priority. It really makes a difference in terms of how well those students are served at that campus because it sets the tone for the campus. And that's what we've seen in our research is that the colleges that are meeting these needs and that are really educating large numbers of low-income students are doing so through strong, concerted leadership at the top.
Mamie Voigt, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mamie Voigt, Executive Vice President of Policy Research at the Institute for Higher Education Policy. Also, John Marcus, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
John Marcus is the higher education editor for the Hechinger Report. That's a nonprofit, independent news organization focused on inequality and innovation in education. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.